Has intent for information on educational purposes only, not for the purpose of rendering medical advice. As always, information should be pulled from multiple credible sources. Cross-reference warmly. Your almost accurate hypothesis evidence can support. Always seek the advice of a physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any question regarding a medical condition.
This is the Actual PT Podcast, where actual problems meet actual evidence, producing actual results. And your hosts, Troy Lind and Taylor Flocken.
Hello, Actual PT Nation. We're back at it again. Taylor Flocken, Troy Lind, just rocking with you. What's up, Taylor Flocken?
Oh, I'm hot, Troy. I'm hot on this topic.
Hot topic. Hot button issue.
Oh,
hot buttons.
Oh, the buttons are being pressed. My buttons are being pressed with this one.
Being pressed there, Doc.
Mm-hmm.
Being pressed. So today, Actual PT Nation, we're talking about another hot topic issue that a lot of people hear about it, but there's a lot of misconception around it in common knowledge or kind of layperson knowledge, if you will. Well, I guess even in the medical field, it doesn't matter if you're there or not. There's a lot of mistakes being used, surprisingly. Which you are looking forward to diving into. But the topic that we're talking about is lateral elbow tendinopathy, or tennis elbow, as 99.999999999% of people out there call it.
Yep.
Or tendonitis is probably what they most likely call it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But anyways, let's just dive right in. What is it, Taylor, and what's got you so stinking hot?
All right. Well, we are looking at lateral epicondylitis. That is the medical term, but it is such a misnomer because we're not dealing with an itis here. We're dealing with an osis.
Yep.
And what has me so hot about this is we have known this since 1970. This has been confirmed since 1970.
That was before I was born, Taylor Flocken.
Before I was born, too.
Well before.
Well before. I think you could take both of our birthdays and add them together, and it's still not enough years.
Correct.
So this was confirmed in 1970 by Dr. Nerschel, who did a histological study of over 600 cases.
That's a lot back then.
Tennis elbow. Exactly, yeah.
For evidence, that was a bunch.
And for people out there wondering what histology is, that's like the study of the actual makeup of like a tissue sample of like muscle and, you know, what's all in there. Are we talking collagen? Are we talking scar tissue, mm-hmm. fibroblast?
Mm-hmm.
So part of what has me so hot on this topic is I have yet to come across a doctor, this includes orthopedic surgeon, who seems to really know the difference between an itis and an osis.
They just fly off the cuff, tendonitis, every time.
Tendonitis.
Every single time.
Yep. And
oh, it hurts? Must be a tendonitis.
Absolutely. And I mean, I've had, I've explained to patients about it. They go to their doctor and the doctor's like, no, it's an itis. There's no osis here.
Even though they've been hurting for a year.
Exactly. So part of the reason I'm so hot about this is itis. That is going to be something really, really acute. Something, there is an injury that you can point to, and there is an inflammatory response that resolves within 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
With an osis, there is an actual change. There is a degeneration of the tissue itself. And this occurs, this is almost always kind of like a chronic overuse type issue.
Yep.
And it just kind of keeps building and building and building. And that's exactly what's happening in lateral epicondylitis, osis. I prefer osis.
That's why a lot of times we just say, oh, how long has this been going on? Oh, it's been hurting me for like a year. It's like, what acute injury, acute phase, which everyone that's in the medical field knows that's like 3 weeks or less, on the long end.
Yeah.
3 weeks or less. Mm-hmm. That's acute. So it's like, what doctor is not understanding that chronic is what you're in? You're in a chronic issue, and that is not possible with an itis.
Well, and I mean,
unless it's re-injury, acute on chronic.
Oh, yeah.
That doesn't count. Then it's back to acute again.
Exactly. And you know, for us, we spent 3 years really kind of diving into the weeds of, you know, the neuromusculoskeletal system, biomechanics, and the rehabilitation thereof. A lot of, a lot of doctors, they have like just a couple courses on
general.
And by courses, I mean lectures.
Yes.
Yeah.
Not even hands-on.
Yeah. We're talking a couple days in class on this information. And so at the end of the day, I think it's fair to say that we're a little bit more.
No, we are better.
In this subject.
Well, I mean, just think about how many tests and measures we do hands-on. Mm-hmm. How many times do we actually do manual tests on the patient compared to what the MD does, where he just lets his nurse writes down what's happening to you. He walks in the room because he's a generalist, and that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But he walks in the room and he's like, oh, sounds like this. Like, their PT's wrong. Tonight, yeah. For sure. Like, you have not done a thing.
You don't know anything about this.
Oh, let's get an x-ray. Oh, really? Is that going to help you? No.
No.
Nope.
Nope. Yeah. And kind of going further into exactly what it is, and my little rant is a little, I got some steam out of me. So with this subject, people will typically affects people who do like a lot of gripping, and there is an overuse of the wrist extensors. And that seems to be a little counterintuitive, because gripping, you're like, well, what do you use those for? And it goes back to the fact that every single muscle in your body has a length strength relationship. So if you want to like test this out really quick and see the role that the extensors do, hold your arms kind of like out in front of you. Now bend your, kind of like you're holding a soda can. Now bend your wrist towards you. And now you should kind of have like a, kind of like a weird L shape between your wrist and your forearm. And now try to grip as hard as you can. Feel how that feels. And now hold your hand in a normal position and grip as hard as you can. You should be able to feel a pretty appreciable,
stronger.
Yeah, really big difference in strength there. And that's what the wrist extensors do. They hold your wrist in as good of a position as possible so you can grip as hard as you can. And that, and there tends to be an overdevelopment of the grips of the wrist and finger flexors compared to the other side, the outer part of that elbow, those wrist extensors. They just eventually start degenerating from overuse. And with that, we had a really smart sounding term here, angiofibroblastic hyperplasia.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is fancy, right?
Yeah.
But what does it mean, Taylor? I get it's fancy. And also, mm-hmm. I just want to pause you for 1 second and say that I don't like how you said soda. It's definitely pop.
Can we meet in the middle on soda pop?
Probably not, but continue.
Okay. Yeah. So let's just kind of like break down the word a little bit. I think the part here that'll make most sense to most people, the fibro in there. So fibro, you're going to be thinking more like scar tissue, the form of a fibrous or a whole bunch of fibers. And blastic, that just means to kind of like create or to grow. Yep. So we're growing scar tissue. And hyperplasia, that just means there's an overgrowth of it.
Yep.
So an overgrowth of scar tissue forming cells, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
And so that affects the quality of the tendon. And the wrist extensors, the wrist and finger extensors, it's a huge series of muscles. Like, if you ever want to get confused, just Google image it. There's a whole bunch there. It's pretty overwhelming when you first look at it. But they have this characteristic where most of them kind of all meet and conjoin into one common tendon. And so that tendon, it just kind of keeps getting wrenched on. And eventually there's a degeneration in it. And that's what we call the angiofibroblastic hyperplasia. And scar tissue, it's just not as strong as the normal real thing. I believe 80% strength 80%. Is the accepted number.
Yep.
So it's just not as strong. And also it's less, how do you want to say, elastic in nature. It's, you know, instead of
responds to stress more poorly. For sure.
Yeah. And all of the muscle bellies in general, instead of them being like, you know, a nice strong rubber band that is able to contract and hold strong, they become more kind of like a frayed rope, I think is.
Yeah. That's a good way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot. The biggest issue is they're not uniform. A tendon should all have all uniform, concise, everything
fibers.
All fibers should be running in parallel or the way, you know,
in the direction
organized.
Of force.
Yeah. In the direction of force. Yeah. But when this happens, it kind of just imagine everything gets gunked up. Imagine instead of having a well-formed highway, there's a bunch of construction going on and it's kind of hectic.
It's just all over everyone. The place. Yeah.
Whenever there's construction, there's traffic, right? I mean, let's be honest.
So yeah.
And think about it like that.
And part of what makes this area of the body just so prone to it is that there is a traditionally very poor blood supply to it. And that tends to also be part of the reason it takes so long to get better from, which I think we'll talk about that a little bit later.
Well, I mean, that's why we get so upset about this, right? Mm-hmm. Is that an itis?
Yes.
There's an acute ordeal. There's inflammation. So the biggest issue is that there was an acute injury, an acute exacerbation, and the inflammation and the pain from the inflammation is what's causing dysfunction, rather than the osis is due to lack of blood supply after following an acute exacerbation. It doesn't heal properly, so now you have a limited blood supply. You have a lack of inflammatory mediators, not enough of them, which leads to this angiofibroblastic hyperplasia. But this is why we get so worked up. They are completely different issues.
Yes. And this carries forward into the treatment of it. I've had doctors do literally the thing that you are not supposed to do with it, which we'll cover that whenever we get into treatment. But if we as healthcare professionals do not understand the issue and go about trying to treat it, or, you know, like the core foundation of the problem, we're going to do inappropriate things that either, you know, does nothing and is a waste of resources, or can actually cause harm, as in the case that we'll talk about later.
Yeah. And I mean, do you have the time frame in front of you off the top of your head? I got it.
I got it. So, well, maybe I do. So I think it's something about like 80 or 90% of cases resolve within 9 months on their own. So this is what we call a self-limiting condition. And that just means that the problem will come on its own, but it'll also leave on its own without any treatment.
Yeah. And evidence shows that, because like you said, majority will if they do it properly. But a lot of it, you're looking at a 6 month to 2 year time frame.
Exactly.
Are the numbers they give. So imagine having the doctor make the wrong decision in something that's already possibly up to 2 years.
Yeah.
And if they make the wrong decision, you're definitely hitting the 2 year mark. I mean, this is something that just lingers and lingers if it's not dealt with properly.
Yeah. This is a problem. Whenever I have a patient come in, you know, there has to be a ton of education about that fact. Yeah. You know, the good news is this is a problem that will go away on its own. Bad news is this, on average takes about 9 months to 2 years for it to do that.
Yeah.
The role of physical therapy though is to reduce the severity of symptoms and allow the person to be functional, because I mean, gripping is that's foundational for so many activities.
Everything.
It's to reduce the severity of symptoms and then also potentially reduce the recovery time, which we actually have some really promising things on the horizon with that, which, you know, compared to some of the past couple of episodes, it doesn't seem like we've had a whole lot.
This one we're actually good at dealing with. And the more evidence that comes out, the more support we have for two or three, I would say, tools that really have been standing out recently.
Yeah. And well, and, you know, I will say there isn't like a ton of research on, you know, those on those tools. But, you know, kind of similar to some of the nerve entrapment stuff, there is a lot of evidence on stuff that doesn't work.
Like treating an itis, like, or treating an osis like an itis, for instance.
Yeah, exactly. And just to kind of finish up a little bit of what it is, there's one new thing. Kind of looking at research, that there is potential that part of the thing that makes it so painful is that there is a damaged and poorly functioning localized sympathetic nervous system. So the nerves around that area, they become damaged, probably due to the lack of circulation to that area, and they start kind of misfiring, and they can affect what the sympathetic system can do in that area that can affect the problem is it can affect the vasculature, and that can further exacerbate the lack of circulation. And, you know, we call that essentially ischemia, when the area becomes very, very poorly circulated with blood or completely cut off from blood. And that in and of itself is painful.
The old ischemias is not
the ischemia.
The ischemias is not bueno.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you brought that up. I have a point later on that I'll hit on for the prognostic factors that actually directly correlates to what you just said.
Oh, wow.
Directly related.
Oh, you know. Wow, I didn't know that. That's nice.
So I'm glad you said that.
Yeah. But Mr. Roy, tell the people about some of the signs and symptoms for this.
Yes. So this person, so as kind of a quick recap, so this person's going to be an overuse type of individual, a laborer, a tennis player, and they're going to be 35 to 54 years old.
Wait, are you saying you don't have to play tennis to be able to get this?
Correct. It is tennis elbow, but sometimes it's working on a manufacturing line. Elbow.
Oh.
Yeah. So,
okay.
That's awkward, but
yeah.
Smokers are at higher risk of this. Mm-hmm. And I just want to reiterate that it's repetitive movement at the wrist, not at the elbow with your activity.
Correct.
That causes it, which is, as we said, a common misconception.
Well, and, you know, just looking at biomechanics, most of the muscles that have the strongest effect on the wrist, they originate, or the fingers, they originate at the elbow.
At the elbow.
Either the inner side for flexor or for the flexors, or the other outer side for the extensors.
Yeah. So the signs and symptoms for this individual, they're going to have tenderness with palpation, so pushing on or touching at the lateral forearm. So you're looking at that lateral epicondyle. If you know where that is, Google it. If you don't, that's okay.
It's on the humerus.
It's on the humerus.
It's not a very humorous condition.
It's
though.
Not humorous, though, no.
No.
It's not funny. And it's you're usually having about 2 centimeters distal to the insertion. So you're right on that tendon, right where that tendon's being overworked. You also have pain into the dorsal surface of the forearm, so the backside of the forearm. That originates still from, again, the lateral epicondyle, so that kind of outer rough spot of the elbow. And then the kind of the biggest factors that we identify for this are grip strength differences. So your grip strength is going to be weaker in extension than it will be in flexion. And this, the evidence kind of shows approximately 26% on average weaker in extension than flexion. And there will be a significant increase in pain in this positioning with gripping.
No, 100%. And part of the reason for this, and I probably should have mentioned this earlier. There's 2 primary muscles that seem to be involved in the vast majority of cases. The first one, and I think this one's like 2/3 of cases, involves this one.
Yeah.
That is the extensor carpi radialis brevis.
Which everyone knows.
Which,
what that is.
Oh yeah, simple layman term there. Just for time's sake, we're just going to call it the ECRB. And honestly, if you Google the letters ECRB, it'll actually pop up because that's what we mostly just refer to it as.
Gotcha.
But that muscle, so it attaches part of the reason why the, gripping is so different whenever the arm is like, or the elbow is fully straight. It's because that ECRB, it attaches before the joint line, I guess. So it's before your elbow there. And then you have like a bunch of other muscles that attach above the joint line. So whenever the arm is straightened out, that puts a lot of the other muscles that would normally help the ECRB into a, what is it? Passive insufficiency because it's lengthened. Yeah. Into passive insufficiency, which that goes back to the length strength relationship I was talking about earlier. You have a
point. I should say, so basically to make it easy, when the arm's straight, one muscle has to do everything.
One muscle. Yeah.
And it's the muscle that majority of the time gets hurt.
Don't get me wrong. The other ones that are trying to help, they're just not able to help nearly as much.
They don't have a good pull.
And I did, I forgot to mention the other muscle responsible. That is going to be the extensor digitorum. He straightens out your fingers, in case you're wondering.
Yeah. He extends them.
He extends them. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the other last sign and symptom kind of from a PT standpoint, you're able to separate it into mild or severe categories based off the use of a questionnaire. It really doesn't matter which one, but if you want to look it up, it's patient rated tennis elbow evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
And basically the only way you know if it's severe is if the score is greater than 54.
Yeah.
So it's not as it's a little bit more cut and dry. It's kind of just severe, moderate, and it's kind of gray, everything in between.
That's fair.
Yeah. Now that we've covered the signs and symptoms, we know what this person looks like. We know what it is and what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So this individual now knows that they have the tennis elbow, quote unquote. What's the treatment look like, Theo Falcon?
So the treatment actually kind of depends on who you go see first.
Sadly, yes.
Yeah. So if the initial visit with that a patient would see is with a surgeon, they are 12 times more likely to have surgery.
That is just outrageous.
And the
comical almost.
And just like with almost all of a lot of the rest of the research with this, I mean, the surgical outcomes are mixed. There's some studies that say, hey, you know, there is improved function or even pain after a year. But there are also other ones that say, you know, it's really not that much better than just going the, you know, more conservative route. Mm-hmm. And there's also a fair amount of disagreement on the proper techniques to use, which I didn't dive too deep into the techniques just because it's not really my shtick. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they still haven't found the one technique that seems to be best, and they don't know when to use one over the other quite yet.
There's still a big question mark with regards to surgical intervention with this, which makes it even more comical as to why they just want to jump to cutting every time.
Yeah.
Especially when the patient says they're severe, but the guy hasn't even touched him. Surgeon hasn't even touched him yet.
No. And so kind of jumping to what we can do for them, I think one of the biggest ones that I would want to start with is, and part of the reason for this is actually for differential diagnosis to make sure we are looking at a tennis elbow, because there's another condition that mimics this very closely. And this is one of the best ways to kind of distinguish between the two. We want to give the patient a counterforce brace. And, you know, I don't really like the name. I think the name makes it sound fancier than it really is. It's literally just a strap that has like a little, I guess like, I don't know, extra bump on the inner part of it that touches your skin. And you want to put that over over that tendon. And essentially what this does is it changes where the muscle is pulling from. It kind of changes the attachment point a little bit and allows it. Yeah. It moves it closer to the muscle belly where there isn't a problem as opposed to the tendon. So it's not pulling on that tendon nearly as hard. Now, what I do with people is I will have them, okay, go ahead and grip something for me without anything on. I'll then have them put the thing on. And if they say, oh, you know, this is actually quite a bit better, that's usually a very good indicator because it should be almost immediate relief. Mm-hmm. And we highly, highly, highly recommend people continue to wear this thing for as any time they're going to be doing any type of gripping or heavy activity. It can be uncomfortable because it does need to be fairly tight. Mm-hmm. But in terms of differential diagnosis, it can help, but like initially when you put it on, but if it starts to make the pain worse, starts to make the problem worse, what you're actually probably looking at then is a nerve entrapment issue.
Which we hate.
Yeah. Which as if you've listened to the last two episodes, you know, we hate them.
Yes.
So we are very, very hopeful that, this thing will help and not hurt the patient. And specifically, pin entrapment, that stands for posterior interosseous nerve.
Yes. And those are also called CHOPAT straps, right?
Oh, are they?
I think that's what I've heard it called, referred to as. I don't know. I know that's what they use on the knee.
Oh, you know what? Maybe it is that also called that.
Yeah. I think it's just a second term I've heard thrown around.
Yeah. But, I mean, they're very cheap. You can get them off Amazon for 15 bucks,
yeah,
you know,
15 bucks. Yeah.
So that's going to be like my first thing I'm going to be going after with these people. The next thing, I'll be honest, we do not have like any, controlled studies for it. It's still a pretty new intervention and we just haven't studied it yet, but on the anecdotal level, it has been incredible. And that is blood flow restriction training or BFR. So essentially you put a glorified blood pressure cuff really high up on the limb to cut off blood supply to that limb. And then you have the person do an exercise typically for around 75 reps and then that's it. In terms of why this helps, I honestly could not tell you. I don't know.
Possible return of those inflammatory mediators, but who knows?
Yeah, maybe improved circulation throughout the entire arm as the blood flow returns. But some interesting things about the BFR, like side notes, is that it tends to have a what we call analgesic effect, which means that it actually provides pretty significant pain relief in the short term. And that's part of the reason for that. And this is dependent on you getting the load right, by the way. If you sufficiently fatigue the muscle, it's going to release a lot of endorphins, which that's the stuff that gives you like the runner's high. So there tends to be, you know, short-term pain relief. And then there's a lot of other hormonal things that happen with BFR. And I think that's the most likely reason it has such a significant improvement. And speaking about it from my own use with it for tennis elbow, I had a patient that I was seeing for, I think we had probably been working like 4 or 5 weeks. She unfortunately was terrible with her exercises, which for this condition is just typically very detrimental. And we just really weren't getting anywhere. Well, we eventually, I'm like, well, you know what? Let's try this thing. We threw the BFR on, and after that first session, because she ended up doing a bunch of traveling, I didn't see her for several weeks, but she came back and she said she had actually been pain-free for the first time in like 6 months for the vast majority of the time that we were separated. And so I threw it on her again, and by and large, she's been pain-free. So 2 applications of BFR, and suddenly we're making huge progress. Mm-hmm. And you know, I've had a couple of other patients like that. And from the course that I took, the guy said, if you get the load right, it really doesn't take too many to get this thing kicked in the butt. So I think that's a huge tool that I'm really looking forward to seeing more research on for this condition.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's just a matter of time.
BFR
in general has just blown up recently, and it's just going to, start snowballing,
which is good.
No. More evidence, more tools.
No, absolutely. Another really popular tool for treating this, dry needling. Throwing some darts into that elbow. I guess the physiologic reasoning behind it is it just helps a ton with circulation. So the blood supply, improving that to the area, I mean, blood just means healing.
Yeah, and I can speak on this one because I've used this one, or my CI did when I was working as a student. But we had a patient that came in, had a tennis elbow from golfing, which is kind of funny. Funny because there's a golfer's elbow.
Yeah,
that's not what she had.
despite the name.
Yeah, exactly. But anyways, she is having symptoms for 2 years.
Jeez.
Yeah, chronic, long, never went away, just couldn't get it to go away. Came in for dry needling twice, cleared up immediately.
Incredible.
Yep. That's all we did. We just saw her twice, dry needled her twice, gave her a couple exercises. She did them and cleared right up. And like you said, the theory behind it is you're increasing blood flow. You're resetting, you're doing two things. You're resetting the nervous system about how to reuse that segment.
Is that the note that you were talking about earlier when I mentioned the damaged nervous system?
There's two.
Oh, there's another thing.
Okay. But there's two theories behind it. One, you're increasing blood flow, which is actually restarting that inflammatory cascade, which is what it needs to heal.
It actually needs it.
Yeah, and there is huge evidence behind that. So that is occurring every time you needle an area that blood flow is increasing. And the second is resetting the nervous system to function properly. You're teaching it to rework as a unit again, contract properly, everything you want to say that comes with that, increased proprioception, all that stuff. I've also seen huge positives with that as well.
That's awesome. Kind of going further down the list, we're starting to get into things where the evidence, it's just a little bit more shaky, which I think is the reason why you shouldn't just use one therapy for this patient. You should be combining things. And the next on the list is manual therapy. And there is actually one specific technique that seems to be particularly helpful, and that is the Mills manipulation.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, and this is another one that I don't know that I really understand why it helps. The therapist will use kind of like a belt. It'll go like over their shoulder. It'll go underneath the arm, and they'll kind of pull your elbow up while it's flat on the table. And then you just have the patient grip, and gripping, especially like in that straightened position, normally very painful. But if this helps it, this tends to help push the problem along in a positive way.
Yeah. Not exactly sure why, but it's just a restore of function. I don't know. I'm just hypothesized, so I'm not even going to try.
You know, I don't even know that I can really, what's the word? There was another word. I don't know. I can't.
Words.
I, Yeah, words. There's some words I'm trying to say, but yeah, I can't even begin to try. I can't even begin to try, really. It kind of goes against what I feel like I know, but I don't know. And I have used it, and I have had people say, oh, you know, that actually is quite a bit better. But then also like deep tissue, trying to increase circulation either to the area or to the affected muscles. And then B, also try to reduce some of the stiffness in them. Because if they're stiffer, they're going to be pulling on that tendon harder. And, you know, that just kind of further, takes it down the negative cascade.
Yep.
Next thing that I also normally have people do is progressive tissue loading. So what this essentially is this is, and I tell patients this, do not think of this as like a strengthening exercise. This is a healing exercise because we are looking to try and stimulate a healing response in the muscle. And so normally what we'll start with is an isometric where we just have a patient more or less resist against wrist extension, typically from themselves, hold that for 5 seconds, do that for a set of 10, and then do that a couple times a day. And we want patients to actually get to the point of discomfort, but we do not want them to creep over into pain because it's all about trying to stimulate a positive healing response in that tendon. And so you start with the isometric and then you go into a little bit loaded and then eventually you get into eccentric. And for this particular muscle, you don't normally get into any explosive movements with it, really.
No reason to.
Yeah. There's evidence going both ways on the progressive loading. But once again, I think you should use a combination of therapies to really try and push this thing along. And then going on to modalities, this is where there's a ton of evidence on what to not use.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The only modality that seems to have had any type of positive response is laser. Ultrasound doesn't seem to be helpful. Shockwave doesn't seem to be helpful. So maybe throw a little laser on there if the clinic has it. But my clinic, I've personally never worked in a clinic that had it.
Never once.
Been able to have a pretty positive results with some of the other therapies listed above that we've gone over.
Yep.
And I think that's about it in terms of. There is one more thing.
Yes, I have a, my tidbits on prognosis.
Yeah, yeah. Why don't you jump into that?
So I found an article, which is funny. The article, it's directly, I think it was just talking to Taylor. Basically, the title of the article is Management of Lateral Elbow Tendinopathy, One Size Does Not Fit All by Brooks K. Coombs et al. It was published in JOSPT in November 2015. So it's not new by any means. But basically, the entire article basically goes on to state, you know, what it is, how to diagnose it, and that you should use several. It should be your treatment should be directly related and correlated to the signs and symptoms of that person. It should be directly tailored to the person. You cannot just use one treatment to solve all tennis elbows. It has to be, like you said, it has to be a combination of all that you're doing. And in this article, it talks about several factors to that kind of help with identifying prognosis. So one of them being, as you're talking about, sympathetic or parasympathetic systems are involved. It goes on to say that evidence shows that there's a heightened nociceptive withdrawal reflex and widespread mechanical hyperalgesia. So it says that a subgroup of patients reporting severe levels of pain and disability displayed cold hyperalgesia, which is right around 13.7 degrees Celsius, whatever that is in Fahrenheit. So while cold pain threshold was an independent predictor for short and long-term prognosis in untreated individuals, it is consistent with other MSK pain conditions such as whiplash, which shows that pain thresholds greater than 13 degrees Celsius have been directly linked to increased risk of persistent pain.
What?
Yeah. So like you said, it's being,
that is fascinating.
Yeah. So,
okay.
So basically, a prognostic factor for us is if you're having, cold hyperalgesia in the elbow with a tennis elbow, then you're probably going to have worse outcomes because the sympathetic system becoming involved.
Hyperalgesia meaning increased pain.
Increased pain with cold.
Increased pain with cold.
Yeah. So when you get cold, something cold on your elbow, you think it's extremely painful.
That is fascinating.
Which, if you don't know, is not normal.
which I think it drives the point further and further home. This is not an inflammatory condition.
Yes, even farther. Yeah. Because if it was, then the cold would feel great.
The cold would actually be helpful.
Yeah. It'd decrease the pain instead of increase pain. Another prognostic factor, which kind of goes in, more with regards to what we're talking about with resetting the nervous system. It says, moreover, self-report of shoulder or neck pain in patients with LET, tennis elbow, presenting to general practice was indicative of poor short and long-term prognosis, respectively, and that was normally between C4 and C7 pain. So they were finding a direct link between neck pain and longer, poorer outcomes.
Interesting. I mean,
so that there was some form of either segmental involvement or double crush type thing. I mean, there's a link in the nerve. They were finding that a kink in the nervous system in some way was affecting poor outcomes.
Well, and I mean, if there is a affected nerve issue, like, you know, in the elbow itself with the sympathetic nervous system, if there's any impaction up the chain, I mean, that just makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Those are almost connected, right?
I mean, yeah.
if there's neck pain, so you know for a fact there's a cervical component, the nervous system is involved, and then you have cold hyperalgesia, which is also connected to the nervous system and the sympathetic system, you're seeing widespread changes to the area. So it makes sense why it'd be worse prognosis. That's, it's kind of pointing towards the severe cases, I would assume. But. The last one that they found was that handling heavy loads and repetitive movements, as well as low job control. Not sure what low job control exactly means, but they didn't specify. And individuals adopting non-neutral wrist positions during work activity have been shown to have a poor prognosis. So basically, it all points back to the fact that if you are unable to adapt what you do, because the number one treatment, which I think we forgot to say, is not doing what's hurting it. Pretty sure we forgot that one.
That's a kind of a big one.
Yeah. So basically, when you see a PT, the first thing they're going to say is, what hurts the most at work that you do that's causing this issue? Stop that.
Yeah.
Don't do that anymore. That's number one. And then everything else we talked about. But
I think that's also related to the use of that, counterforce brace or choke part strap. If that can change your symptoms and you know you're not worse during or after you do the activity, you can do that thing then. 100% get after it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But if you're exacerbating, if it's increasing the pain, and that's when you know every time I go to work on Monday and I do this movement, it hurts, then stop doing that movement.
Yeah. Yeah. I just had somebody the other day. We had done a BFR twice with them and they were noticing fantastic results, and they had actually been pain free for an entire day, like the day after the second treatment. And then they went and played golf.
Nice.
And then they threw the problem into the other direction and they didn't wear their brace. And I was just kind of like, yeah, yeah.
Oh, another golfer that has tennis elbow, huh?
Huh, that's interesting.
Maybe it should be called Golfer's Elbow 2.0.
Maybe we should name conditions after sports or activities.
that just goes to show that everything's connected. Mm-hmm. One treatment or one size does not fit all with this. Nope. And as always, this time we don't have direct evidence saying it, but I would assume earlier intervention's better. Because we're on a roll at this point, I might as well just put it in every podcast, even though we don't have evidence directly saying it this time.
Yeah, and I'll say, because I say it almost every time after you say that, if you're having symptoms that, like, any of the stuff we've gone over today is hitting home with you and it's been consistent for, like, 2 or 3 weeks, go get checked out.
Yeah, and that's not being – and we – as I said, I mean – this one, I don't think it's as nearly as detrimental if you wait a little longer, because obviously, you know, we have instances of 2 years down the line, it still can go away and all that stuff. But
I mean, at the end of the day, there are some people we're not going to be able to help with this.
Yeah. And, I mean, especially with the movements, right? If they just, their job is what it is and you can't change it, and the muscle quality or the tissue quality isn't there. It just kind of
symptoms, especially like any autoimmune issues. I think that's also very important for the PT at the during the initial eval. Say, hey, you know, we're going to throw everything we have at this, but if we aren't successful, we're going to have to, I'm not going to get in your way of any further treatment. And in that case, if nothing is helping the patient, you know, their surgery might be indicated for them.
Yeah, and stop smoking.
Please stop
smoking. What number is this that we've? I couldn't even tell you which one. This is probably almost every episode that we've said smoking is a large indicator of poor tissue quality.
Well, and part of the reason for that, smoking is a body-wide vasoconstrictor. It restricts blood supply, and for healing of X, Y, or Z condition, that is a negative thing.
Yeah, and it increases inflammatory mediators across the entire body systemically.
Yeah.
Which is not good, if you're wondering.
A lot of people don't know that. And, you know, I think with smoking in particular, we have to be kind of careful how we broach the subject. But
especially habit-based, it's tough.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a phenomenal piece of education there for those people.
Maybe we should do an episode on smoking.
Oh, maybe we should.
Or tobacco use, because it also paralyzes the cilia in the lungs. So that's why you have the cough. Because you no longer have, you're no longer getting rid of the sputum. You have to cough it up every time.
Yeah, the cilia aren't picking up all the little particles.
They're not warming away like they should.
They're not warming, bro.
Not warming, Chuck.
I don't like that.
I have nothing else to provide this conversation, and I don't even know if I want to talk to you any longer. So
last episode?
Last episode on tennis elbow.
So far. I don't think I have anything much either. Good. Yeah, I think we Good. Hit, I think Good. We hit all the major notes. Good. We actually hit a lot wrap more on the wrap nervous system. Okay.
Yeah, wrap it up. I'm done.
Keep it spicy.
Classy.
Classy.
This is a bad trend.
we're back. We forgot one additional treatment, and that is injections. And this is actually another point of contention that we PTs have with some of the doctors or even some of the orthopods out there. One of the first line of treatment that a lot will try to do is a cortisone injection, which for a lot of conditions can be extremely helpful.
A lot of itises. A lot of inflammatory.
It tends to be very helpful, and it can actually create a window where we can get a lot more done with therapy.
Yeah.
In some ways, this is not so different because studies have shown it to be helpful in the short term. But when you start talking about the long-term effects, it actually makes things worse.
Yep.
Patients actually have worse outcomes long-term with the injection. And I think part of the reason is that steroid injections, they weaken tendons. That is one of the risk factors of doing too many steroids. That's exactly what's happening here. It adds further degeneration to an already degenerated tendon
and decreases inflammatory mediators, which is already decreased, as you know, check your knowledge from earlier this episode. But we just said that's the issue.
We need
more of them.
Exactly.
We need it to heal itself.
Exactly. And so that is that's kind of like a huge thing with it. I will say, though, looking at research, and research, as with many of the other things with tennis elbow, it's a little bit mixed, but PRP injection may be something that is beneficial. If they're going to inject anything, definitely ask what they're doing. I would say no to the cortisone shot, but the PRP, yeah, why not?
It's had some beneficial evidence coming out slowly but surely. It's kind of still controversial, you know. It's kind of 50-50 still, but there is some promising evidence for it, which makes sense.
The one problem with it, though, is a lot of insurances don't cover it, so there is a typically a significant out-of-pocket cost. One person, I know they didn't have the best of insurance, and I think their out-of-pocket cost was like $1,000. Yeah.
Especially when this is something that can fairly be controlled based on the treatments we've already given, which are usually reimbursed through insurance.
Yeah, I will say though, I think there will, I have spoken with someone, I think their injections were actually in the range of $200 or $300. So far better, but still, if you're going to go down that route, just be prepared to, cough up a few extra bones.
And try not to let them cut you up right off.
Yeah. I think we're good now. I think we're good.
Now you're fine with it.
I am.
So now you've done what you were supposed to do.
I did what you were supposed to remind me to do.
Goodbye, Actual PT Nation.
Bye.